One of the premier broadcast news organizations in our country advertises its major news magazine, loaded with crime stories, with the tagline, "Don't Watch Alone." People live in gated communities with bright lights shining on the outsides of their houses all night. The president won office in part by promising to build a big wall between the United States and Mexico. Fear of someone getting us in either a societal or personal sense permeates American society. This is a theme explored in the post-Second World War period by our next guest in a book called Fortress America, How We Embraced Fear and Abandoned Democracy. Elaine Tyler May is a professor of American Studies and History at the University of Minnesota. She is the former president of the Organization of American Historians and the author of 6 books in all. Elaine Tyler May, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
Good to have you. So how do you write a book on scared people and not make it scary itself?
Well, yeah, it wasn't the happiest project I've done, to be sure, but I was interested in understanding how and why Americans are so obsessed with security, their own personal security, as well as national security, and how those two aspects of our lives in the nation intersect and reinforce each other. So that's what drove me towards this project, and then I began to encounter all the ways in which Americans seem to fear bodily harm and what they do about it. And the surprising thing to me was that pretty much everything Americans did to try to keep safe and secure did nothing to make them safer or more secure, and in fact made them and the country less safe. And I was pretty surprised to see that outcome.
Is there a particular poster child example that rings through above all others?
Well, there's so many, actually. Pretty much everything that people do to try to remain physically safe actually does no good or makes them less safe. So, for example, people who live in gated communities claim that they move there. The majority claim that they move there for safety and security. But as it turns out, the crime rates for people within gated communities, if you control for socioeconomic level, in other words, if the people who live in a gated community are otherwise like people not living in a gated community, their crime rates in their neighborhoods are the same. The gates don't bring down the crime rate at all. And in fact, the reason that gated communities are often less safe is that emergency vehicles, when there really is a problem, a medical emergency or a fire or something like that, those vehicles can't easily get into these neighborhoods because they're gated and it slows them down. It's also true that children have a false sense of safety when they live behind gates. They don't learn how to be aware of the dangers of traffic on public streets. They think it's safe to run around not only in their communities where they could get hurt by a moving car, but also once they're outside the gates. They also become fearful of people who don't look like them because these communities tend to be very homogeneous, and that creates more fear and more insecurity when they're outside on their own. So that's one example. Another example, we can look at the way in which the media and politicians since the 1960s forward have created an environment in which women are led to feel unsafe when they're out in public. The idea that pretty much at the same time that women, as a result of the feminist movement, started to increasingly enter public life and work life and the public arena more generally, outside of their homes, the clamor by politicians and officials and the media really became a drumbeat that women are not safe on the city streets, especially at night, especially alone, and to be safe, they should be home. Now, if we look statistically from pretty much the last half of the 20th century, and including up until today, what we know now is that women statistically would have been safer out in the middle of the street, in the middle of the night, than in their own homes, because most violence against women takes place not outside their homes, but actually inside their homes, and that the greatest danger to them are people who they know, family members or acquaintances. And that is actually true for pretty much everybody. The vast majority of people who are harmed by other people are harmed by people they know. So we have an exaggerated fear of the stranger and much less awareness that strangers tend not to be dangerous to most people. Most strangers don't harm other people they don't know. That harm tends to be between people who know each other. So those are a few ways that Americans are misled or misguided about where the real dangers are. Many Americans own guns. We have a higher rate of gun ownership in this country than almost every other place in the world. But owning a gun does not make anyone safer. It tends to make them less safe. People who own guns and where there are guns present, there is much more likelihood that people will be harmed by those guns than if there are no guns present. So, you know, all of these things that people do to increase their sense of safety, to make them feel that they can protect their bodies from harm from other people, are actually not making them any safer.
Elaine, we're about a minute away from a break, so if a shorter answer here on just the general concept of the good old days. Were there any? I mean, was there a golden age of security in America?
There's never been a golden age of anything in America. There's just different time periods with different ways of understanding our world and different ways of responding to it. And the whole idea of security being a matter of one's physical safety is located in certain periods of time. You know, in the 1930s, the main fear in terms of security was economic security. And at that time, most Americans turned to the government to help provide a safety net. And now the government is really seen by many Americans as not helpful in their own personal lives. And so they're turning to their own resources and their own personal efforts to make themselves secure.
Elaine Tyler May is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is Fortress America, How We Embraced Fear and Abandoned Democracy. You'll hear some details on that last term in just a few moments as we resume our discussion here on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today to Elaine Tyler May, Professor of American Studies and History at the University of Minnesota. She gives us a look largely at post-World War II America and our obsession with security, both on a personal and a national level. And the book is called Fortress America, How We Embraced Fear and Abandoned Democracy. You can join our conversation on the exchange. Have your thoughts available about how we approach security in America. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So, Elaine, this is a fairly stark thesis that the obsession with security makes healthy society unattainable. Is that your term?
Well, I think that the obsession with security has damaged our democracy because we have not looked to the common good as a way of making the nation safe and individual citizens safe. We've looked to bunker ourselves behind locks and privacy gates and all kinds of individualistic responses, and that has made us more distrustful of other citizens, of people we don't know, of people who don't look like us. It has made us more wary of immigrants who have always contributed so much to our country. And a thriving democracy really cannot exist in a situation where citizens don't feel invested in the common good, feel that the government is really the institution that speaks for and provides the will of the people. And so we have not only suspicion of each other, but we have a suspicion of the government that is supposed to be our representative. So it really does damage our functioning democracy and turn us into a nation that is basically much less secure and safe.
Are we more fearful now or more fearful since the Second World War, or have Americans always been sort of a skittish people?
Well, they've been fearful of different things, and I think there have been times when the fear of personal bodily injury was not so intense as it has been since World War II. And I think what really generated that kind of fear was the early atomic age, when we faced the threat, and we still do, of course, and it's been revived in recent times in scary ways, But certainly the atomic age opened up the possibility that Americans were at risk of massive violence coming from afar that could hit any time without any sort of warning, and that the government really couldn't do anything to protect you. And in those early years of the atomic age, experts and officials and politicians instructed Americans to protect themselves. We can't protect you. You must protect yourselves. Children were taught to dive under their desks if they were at school and they saw a flash. Families, especially fathers who were expected to be the breadwinners in the 1950s and 60s, they were instructed to provide for their family's safety by building bomb shelters or fallout shelters in their yards or constructing safe spaces in their basements. And so the idea was, you're on your own. If you're going to be safe, you need to do something on your own with your own resources to protect yourself and your families.
And yet when natural disasters happen, we seem to know how to work together with each other. But then when we're dealing with people, then is the more human caused disasters are the ones that we get a little freaked out about, it sounds like.
Well, that all really depends as well. We didn't do so well when the levees broke in New Orleans and, people were flooded out of their homes and many died. We didn't do so well in taking people into safe, sheltered places. You know, they were taken into environments that were really horrible and difficult for people to manage, in these, the Astrodome and places like that. So we haven't really done very well with natural disasters either.
Fair point. Elaine Tyler May is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is Fortress America, How We Embraced Fear and Abandoned Democracy. We get the immediate post-war period covered here, and it's interesting to think in terms of how World War II restored some order in the world, but immediately we started getting scared about the Soviet Union, and we got McCarthy, and we got the Communist Control Act. What was that?
Well, there has been a really surprising and I think way overblown fear of communism in this country. And after World War II, and in fact even before World War II, the level of fear and hatred and distrust of anyone who was considered to be either a communist or a communist sympathizer was unbelievably intense. Public opinion polls showed that huge numbers of Americans who claimed to believe in free speech, the next question being, would you allow a communist to speak at a neighborhood meeting in your neighborhood, would say no, right after saying they believed that everyone had a right to their own opinions and they believed in free speech. And many, many, many majorities of Americans felt that simply becoming a member of the Communist Party of the United States, which was just a political gathering, political organization, would be worth not only imprisonment, but some people even felt that membership in the Communist Party should be a capital offense. Really shocking ways in which Americans expressed their fear and hatred of communism and communists, even though the American Communist Party was then and has always been very small and has not been particularly closely attached to any foreign power. But the fear that communists, especially in the early Cold War, that communists could be in touch with Russian spies who would make atomic secrets available to the Russians and they would then drop bombs on the United States. Those fears were very intense in these years, and public opinion polls showed just how deep that fear was.
I'm really surprised to see that in the Communist Control Act, we actually outlawed the Communist Party of the USA. Didn't realize we could do that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Well, so there's this the whole mishmash, though, where we get the fears about communists and threats from nuclear weapons and that sort of thing also seems to dovetail with the rising fear of crime. Which coincides with the post-war scattering of white people to quote-unquote safe suburbs. Now, I do want to ask about that. Given the pent-up demand from depression and war, I mean, do you think there would have been sub-movement out of the city to the suburbs anyway?
Oh, absolutely. No question about that. The real problem with the expansion to the suburbs was the replication of residential segregation. So many suburban areas did not allow black people to move in. There were a small number of suburban communities that either allowed blacks or were primarily black. But what happened was that because there was so much pervasive racism and that was not challenged, these suburban communities were restricted to white people. And what that meant was that for African American families, even those who could afford to move to the suburbs, and many could, but they were not allowed to buy in those suburbs. Now you look at that phenomena long term, and what that means is that you have a working class white family and a working class black family, both of those families earning the same amount of money. The white family can move to the suburbs. The black family is racially prevented from moving to the suburbs. And over the next generation or two, you have the black family pouring money into substandard urban rental property because they're not allowed to buy. The white working class family invests in a home, is able to send their children to college. They have all the benefits of home ownership and mortgages. They're not paying rent. They're able to acquire assets. And you go down in a generation or two and you see a vast, vast discrepancy in the opportunities available to the children and grandchildren of those two families.
And in fact, you re-mention in the book or mention in the book stuff that we had heard about before, the fact that the federal government actually helped white families and didn't. It was the whole process of redlining that we've talked about in the Detroit area, for example, where you simply couldn't get a loan if you lived in certain neighborhoods.
Precisely.
Yeah. So how explicit was this pitch to people? I mean, was it essentially we fight communism with white picket fences?
Well, on some level, that's actually true. You know, that the American way of life was symbolized by the heterosexual nuclear family, the middle class family, that lived in a single family home that could be prevented from mingling with dangerous people. There were actually people in the media and, of course, politicians who made that case pretty explicitly. I think of, for example, Elizabeth Gordon. She was the editor of House Beautiful magazine for 20 years plus. And she wrote articles that basically said, you know, if you live in a single family dwelling, you are able to, on some level, to indoctrinate your children and protect them from subversive ideas. But if you live in a big apartment complex, and especially if those complexes include, you know, people from other countries or people who you don't know and trust, you could be vulnerable to their thinking, their ideas, and those ideas could be subversive. So the single family home in the suburb was actually seen as a bulwark against communism by people like Elizabeth Gordon, who had a lot of power in the media, and a lot of political leaders enforced that as well.
Elaine Tyler May is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, professor of American Studies and History at the University of Minnesota. Her book is called Fortress America, How We Embraced Fear and Abandoned Democracy. You can join the conversation on the Exchange, talk about things that you noticed in your own life, about things that we did to try to beef up our security and ended up with quite the opposite result. 800-838-3760 to join the conversation by phone. By email is jx@jeffnet.org. I want to stick on the housing example for a moment because there's a great story in here of someone who had an idea that went counter to what was the norm at the time. That was Frank Wilkinson in Los Angeles. What do you tell us about him?
Well, he was really a strong proponent of public housing possibilities, as many were at the time. They saw it as a way of helping people, of making housing available to more people that was subsidized by the government. Now, we think of subsidized housing, that usually rings bells that mean welfare, that mean
the projects,
certain kinds of, yes, housing projects. But the truth is that the big housing subsidies after World War II went to suburban homes. The government subsidized the development of those suburban communities and then gave homeowners lots of subsidies through mortgage deductions and all kinds of other benefits and low interest loans. So really subsidized housing was in fact the middle class housing in the suburbs. And people like Wilkerson were very interested in making subsidized housing available to people of modest means. But instead of really looking at the fact that the government was already subsidizing middle class people in single family homes, many people saw these kinds of structures, especially if they were subsidized by the government, as looking like communism, looking like the state is providing for people in ways that people should be providing for themselves. And that created huge amounts of controversy. And he was one among many of the advocates who were really driven out by those beliefs.
And in fact, it was really interesting to hear that he favored putting some decent housing in Chavez Ravine in Los Angeles. And anybody who pays any attention to baseball knows that instead of being home to people, that became home to the Los Angeles Dodgers.
Yes, and you know, that's a particularly sad and ironic situation, because those who favored making that a residential community subsidized by the government, they too were planning to destroy the community that was already there, because they felt they would improve the community if they put in subsidized housing. So that didn't happen, but the community was destroyed anyway by the baseball stadium, which is still there.
It is indeed. Let's take a call here. We have Rika in Grants Pass on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Elaine Tyler May. Her book is Fortress America.
Good morning, Jeff. Good morning, Elaine.
Hi.
Good morning.
It seems to me that the fear here has been about violence in
yes.
various forms.
Mm-hmm.
While the fear that has not been paid attention to or has not been felt enough is the fear of natural hazards like fire and flood.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And here we have Houston allowing housing to be built on reservoir land that's supposed to be flooded when the reservoir is high.
Right.
And
yes.
California, you know, building huge subdivisions of houses within 10 feet of each other.
Up
yes.
in the scrubby
hills,
yeah.
You know,
this
single-family home thing can be carried too far when you have houses so close that they catch each other on fire.
So we fear nature less.
Contact.
So we fear nature less, you're saying, Rika, than what we can do to each other.
Yeah. And nature is, you know, we've had lots of neighborhoods, you know, of half cities, big neighborhoods going up in flames over the last couple decades because the weeds are not controlled. The city codes are not enforced.
All right. Let's get a response from Elaine. Thanks for that, Rika.
Yes, I completely agree with you, and I think you make a very good point there. Those are kinds of dangers that have not been adequately addressed, and there are many other kinds of dangers to individual security that have not been addressed. Most notably, of course, is the huge gap between the wealthy and the poor. We have such large numbers of Americans now who are not economically secure. And, you know, that's been an issue that has only recently come to the fore.
Yeah, when I come back to the concern about nuclear weapons coming from the Soviet Union back in the 50s, in the immediate post-war period, it's interesting that that you point out that President Eisenhower opposed at-home shelters. He wanted more collective sorts of things. I'm struck more than that, though, by the way we seem to be talking on one hand about the gruesome fear of bombs, and yet on the other hand, we had the films for kids that, as you mentioned already, we told them to duck and cover under their desks. You could survive a nuclear war.
Right, but of course you couldn't. And those were the kinds of bits of advice that some security experts call security theater. These are the kinds of things that people are told to do to make themselves feel better, to make them feel like they're doing something. But American families knew, and even children knew, that diving under your desk wasn't going to save you if an atomic bomb dropped, and putting in a shelter in your home wasn't going to save you if an atomic bomb dropped, that these were all ways to make people feel like they could do something to protect themselves, but they weren't really going to make much of a difference if there was an actual attack.
I still wonder how, in this sort of environment, particularly in the 50s, where you know there was a communist under every under rock and tree, or the perception was that that was the case, and people needed bomb shelters too to protect themselves from the communists overseas, how there ever became an anti-nuclear movement, but there became one.
Oh yes, there did indeed, and it started with women, as many of the peace efforts often do, because they are the ones who are understood to be most in need of protecting their children. They have been the ones who traditionally are seen as the protectors of the home. And so the anti-nuclear movement began with housewives who claimed that, you know, the way in which the nuclear arms race was increasing was actually very dangerous for families and children. And the important thing was to de-escalate rather than increase the nuclear arms race, but really to move toward a much more peaceful coexistence.
We'll talk more about security, both on a personal and a national level, with Elaine Tyler May. She's the author of Fortress America, How We Embraced Fear and Abandoned Democracy. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. When you get right down to it, the main topic of this hour is fear. Fear of bombing or otherwise attack from other countries. Fear of being attacked in the streets on a personal level. Fear of all kinds comes together in the book Fortress America by Elaine Tyler May at the University of Minnesota. She's a historian. The book is subtitled How We Embraced Fear and Abandoned Democracy. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 over the phone. Send your emails to jx@jeffnet.org. Let's take a call from Phil in Eureka. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Yes, hi. This is a great subject, probably worthy more than an hour's worth. Let me go down what I wrote down so I make sure I mention certain things. First of all, the GI Bill was what our government presented to the soldiers when they came back from World War II. And so you call it a government program, but that was one of the big programs that was able to convince Americans that America is good and we provide housing. It was sort of a bulwark against the communist frame of mind that we can all do this together. Instead, they have subsidized or underwrote loans for GIs to get homes. Mm-hmm. And you're right. A matter of fact, I think you had it on the program. That there was discrimination within our government related to who could get these loans.
Yes, redlining. Yeah.
Right, redlining. So that's part of what's been, you know, that's what one of the realities are. The other big reality is that the military industry depends on fear propaganda, tremendously so. If you look at the Pentagon budget today, it couldn't survive. If it wasn't for the fact that the American public is propagandized against, the whole world's against us, and we have to go out there and protect ourselves from them. So that's a very big profit incentive, fear. Fear sells, mm-hmm. And you could probably discuss that as well in terms of profit opportunities related to scaring the hell out of people so they behave a certain way.
Yeah.
And, of course, the movies, Hollywood movies. Come on, the best-selling Hollywood movies have guns and chases and bombs and helicopters, you name it. So you can condition generations of people, men especially, to have fear of what's around them. Even though it may have been produced by Hollywood, the human mind makes a transfer from the movie to the real world. Okay. Anyway, I'll listen to the rest of it off the air.
Great. Thanks for the points, Phil. Appreciate that. Let's talk specifically, if we would, Elaine, about the idea that you can make money by creating fear.
Well, yes, of course, and I think all of Phil's points are extremely important and well stated. the GI Bill was a wonderful government program to help boost people after the war, but if you were a GI and you were black, you still, as Phil pointed out, you still couldn't get into the subsidized homes in the suburbs, and nor could you if you were a gay man or a lesbian and did not get a discharge that would make you eligible for GI Bill benefits, and many of them did not achieve those discharges, so they were also excluded. This was really a white heterosexual benefit for most people who took advantage of the GI Bill. And, of course, the profit motive in the military-industrial complex is very key here. We know that, and that's an important thing to keep in mind. I'd also like to talk a bit about the movies, because those are very, very powerful kinds of popular culture products that really do reinforce this culture of fear. One of the things that I deal with in the book is the rise of the vigilante movies, where the vigilante is the hero. We used to think about vigilantes as being criminals. You know, they would take the law into their own hands and they would murder and create havoc. But in these films like Dirty Harry, the Death Wish series of Charles Bronson, and many of the Clint Eastwood movies, the hero is a vigilante. They take the law into their own hands because they believe in the film, the heroes believe, that the law enforcement agencies, that the police are incompetent, that government officials are incompetent, and that unless the brave individual man will take action, and usually these are middle-aged white men who take it upon themselves to clean up a city or go after the bad guys, that's the only way to reduce danger to people and to get rid of the bad guys. Well, that's a very problematic message, and where has it gotten us? It's gotten us to legal vigilantes, what we have now in many states, the Stand Your Ground law, where if anyone is afraid of anyone else, they are legitimately allowed to use deadly force against them. And that's pretty much turning the vigilante outlaw into the vigilante good citizen.
You know, but the movies themselves, and I'm sitting here writing down other things like Standing Tall with Michael Douglas and other examples of that genre that include Dirty Harry and the Charles Bronson movies, and lead to things potentially like Bernie Goetz on the New York subway with the shooting the people he thought were going to attack him. Which kind of boggles the mind, because we continue to hear that, you know, Hollywood is totally run by the liberals, at least as the conservatives would tell you, and yet the viewpoints put out in these movies are very conservative and very about protecting yourself as an individual.
Right. That's right. This is not a partisan issue. You know, what I found was that in terms of public policies, in terms of politicians who run on a law and order platform, there is some liberal conservative leanings that are different, but both political parties have embraced this culture of fear and have used it for political messaging and for popular cultural messaging, you know, what sells. And certainly we have to look not only at Hollywood media, but at newspapers, at television news, where, you know, the saying is, if it bleeds, it leads. And the most horrific kinds of crimes, even if they're extremely rare, those are the things that make headlines and create a sense that these kinds of actions and these kinds of crimes happen a lot more than they actually do, and that increases fear as well.
Goldwater, in particular, was one of the first to really talk about law and order, and that was in his losing 1964 campaign for presidency. We're talking about Barry Goldwater. Was crime at that time as bad as he was portraying it?
Well, it depends on what kind of crime you're looking at. Street crime was increasing in the 1960s. The murder rate did go up slightly, but it was exaggerated to the point where politicians like not only Goldwater, but certainly after Goldwater, 1968, law and order was an even bigger issue with both Richard Nixon and also George Wallace, who was running as a third-party candidate. The sense that when politicians want to persuade people that they will keep them safe, they exaggerate the level of danger that's actually present. And they'll talk about crime increasing when it actually is not. Now, crime did increase somewhat in the 60s, but the increase was vastly exaggerated. And what's interesting is that politicians and the public continued to believe that crime was increasing even in the 1990s and the early 21st century, when in fact violent crime has been decreasing for the last quarter century and is now at the lowest point that it's been in many, many decades. And yet you still have politicians who will say that crime is increasing, vote for me, I will keep you safe. And, of course, when you have political leaders saying that, if you're not looking at the statistics, that's a very powerful message.
It truly is. Let's take another call. We have Jacob and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Elaine Tyler May.
I wanted to mention that fear is natural. You have to teach a baby to fear fire so they don't get burned, or to fear traffic so they look both ways when they cross. But paranoia is an irrational, disproportionate fear that can cause dysfunction of an individual. In a worst case, it borders on psychosis, and it's a form of schizophrenia, paranoid schizophrenia. There's generally a paranoid index that we see in individuals and in society. Mm-hmm. And right now, I have never seen a culture that our culture is very much infused with paranoia. Now, I want to mention the things that contribute to it. The internet, for instance, allows paranoids to luxuriate in the delusions and misinformation. Okay. Drug culture. If you take a population and you give them free-flowing alcohol and marijuana, it will only increase the paranoid index. You know, and you guns, paranoids love guns like zombies love brains. In pop culture, the most popular films are horror films or zombie films, and films about anarchy and the apocalypse. And then you add in terrorism to the mix, geopolitical.
All right.
So we're surrounded by aspects of culture that really contribute to a whole soup of paranoia.
All right. Thanks for that, Jacob. Appreciate that. Elaine, thoughts?
Well, I do think I couldn't fully hear all of Jacob's comments, but certainly we are in a culture in which much of the newspapers, movies, and other messages that are blared out to the citizens are those that will increase their sense that they are vulnerable and increase fear. So that's certainly true.
You know, he mentioned different types of, he mentioned horror films is what I was thinking of that he was talking about. But, and then that raises a question of whether there's some crossover there between the kinds of fears that we really don't want to have, but the kind of fears that we do want to have. I mean, we love roller coasters and we love movies where you know, zombies eat brains and stuff like that. So we like to be scared on some levels.
Well, sure. But I think there's a distinction between a fantasy movie that creates thrills and chills out of zombies and other monsters. Yeah, those are frightening, but they are less tangible, I think, than the films like the Dirty Harry films that are grounded in what looks like contemporary reality. And I think those are the ones that reinforce people's fears of others and distrust of the government and worshipful kind of appreciation of the tough guy who goes out there on his own, and it's almost always a guy, and cleans things up.
How much have you been able to correlate the feelings about crime and the responses to crime and what has become of the crime rate? I mean, you point out in the book, and we've been talking about here, that the most violent crime rates peaked by 1973.
Right.
Since then, we've got the war on drugs, tougher sentences, more people in prison. I mean, is it possible that the crime rate dropped because more people had been locked up?
Well, there are theories that make that claim. However, of the criminal justice scholars that I've looked at, in fact, the opposite seems to be true, that as we have built this huge problem of mass incarceration, what actually happens is that people are arrested and imprisoned for the kinds of really victimless crimes, largely in the drug wars, you know, possession of a certain amount of a controlled substance or using or owning. And they're now lifted into the felony category when they used to be misdemeanors, which means people go to prison for long periods of time. And then when they get out of prison, because of all of these very rigid and very draconian laws, they can't get jobs, and they can't get into public housing, and they can't have access to the kinds of assistance that they might have had at their available to them before. And so what happens is it forces people back into illegal kinds of activities because they can't get legitimate jobs and they can't really take care of themselves and their families anymore. So in fact, mass incarceration has not really prevented crime. It has actually generated more crime because many of these folks would not have been locked up previously and might have simply been able to get on with their lives and take care of themselves and their families.
Elaine, I know you come at this as a historian, not a sociologist, but are there some recommendations for how we can approach life with a bit less fear and our eyes still wide open?
Yes, well, I am a historian, and historians are not good at predicting the future, but I'm also, frankly, an optimist, and this book was painful to write because it's a disturbing story. On the other hand, I really do believe in political activism, and I think when Americans come together and act as citizens and engage in the common good and engage in making a better society, that's the best hope we have. And I think in that way we can reduce fear, we can address our common problems by coming together for the common good, and I think that's the strength of our democracy, and I think we can revive it.
Working together. We are talking to Elaine Tyler May from the University of Minnesota. She's a professor of American Studies and History and the author of Fortress America, How We Embraced Fear and Abandoned Democracy. Elaine, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
All right, take care.